So what we do here, President Smith,
the House Committee on Transportation Economic Development meeting will come to order. Welcome, everyone. Glad you're all here. It must be the drone hearing out of Bend that draws all these folks, or maybe not. Folks, today we're going to go through the agenda in slightly different order. We're going to proceed with the work session on two bills, and then we will move from the work session to HJM 22. Then we'll go into a short public hearing and work session on 3596 and 2468. And then we will finish with HB 3141. We have added a new device to our hearing, which you can see up above us right there. Maybe you can demonstrate that for us, Zach. It's a device that will warn you when the trap door between your seat will open up and drop you out of sight. Tell us, Zach, how that works.
So you'll have green light for a minute and a half, and then at 30 seconds it'll go to yellow, and then it will cut you off at 2 minutes.
And our hope is if we proceed through the initial material quickly enough that when we get to the motorcycle helmet bill, we'll have more than 2, maybe 3 minutes, but we'll wait and see how matters progress. So with that, I am going to open a work session on HB 2167. Zach, can you tell us about the bill?
House Bill 2167 increases maximum reimbursement from the Oregon...
I'm sorry, Zach. Is that the one we're going to carry over?
Yes, it is.
Let me close that work session very quickly without taking action and carry over House Bill 3354 and House Memorial 2 and House Bill 2167 to Friday. And that, with that, we'll now open a work session on House Bill 3174.
House Bill 3174 adjusts the sunset for tax credits for qualified research activities.
Who do we have? Do we have someone on that? I think we don't. This is just a work session. So do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3174 to the floor with the due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
Co-Chair Reed has moved House Bill 3174 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to tax credits. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair, as we've talked about before, the bill as it exists has a blank for the new sunset date should it receive support from the Joint Tax Credit Committee. I believe that's consistent with what we've talked about in our role of judging the merit of the proposal and leaving the revenue impact and the other particulars to the Joint Tax Credit Committee, who can consider it in the context of all the other possibilities.
I think that was the discussion, Mr. Co-Chair, we had this morning in our Tax Credit Committee.
Indeed.
Further discussion? Yes, Representative Smith.
Yeah, I want to say a couple things. Talked to a member of our chamber today who couldn't be here to testify today, who said that he uses this tax credit, he enjoys using it, he runs a small business that is based in research and development, that he paid no income tax in the last year, and that this tax credit, while it was nice to have, had no impact on his expenditures and research and development activities, and that he suspected it had very little impact on the research and development activities of other businesses. His language was stronger than mine. I understand that this is, I'd be more comfortable if we were doing it with no recommendation rather than a due pass recommendation. Leaving a blank for the sunset date is, as far as I can tell, doing absolutely nothing to adjust or increase our ability to evaluate or see if the causal connection is any better than we understand it to be now. The only thing we're tutored by now is that the amount of research development activity has increased, so has almost every kind of activity. And I really hope we won't move this bill unless we do something to it that matters, and not just hope the Tax Credit Committee figures it out. And I guess that's what I'd say about that.
Thank you for those remarks. It's unfortunate your friend didn't appear before us during the hearing. That would have been helpful, but better late than never. Any other comments? Yes, Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to commend Representative Smith for taken lead on this. I think it takes some strong guts to say that, and I'd like to commend him for saying that.
Further discussion? I will remind everyone that this is an interesting opportunity because the bill will appear before the Tax Credits Committee, and these types of issues would be welcome. Perhaps, Representative Smith, you could mention to your friend that opportunity. With that, seeing any further discussion, let's have the clerk call the roll.
Representative Lindsey?
Yes.
Representative Nathanson?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Nope.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
No.
Chair Vance?
Aye.
Chair Reed?
Aye.
The bill passes, and we'll close the work session on 3174, and since it goes to tax credits, we don't need a carrier. Is that correct?
Correct.
So with that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3029. Zach, can you tell us about the bill?
House Bill 3029 prohibits the Department of Land Conservation Development from requiring an area within an urban growth boundary with a population of 10,000 or less to have a transportation financing program.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 3029 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Reed has moved House Bill 3029 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair, are there any amendments proposed on this one? I don't see any, but I thought there were some.
There are none. Am I correct in that, Zach?
I have not seen any amendments.
Okay. Thank you.
Further discussion? Is there objection? See no objection. In fact, I'm going to actually ask for the roll on this one also. Debbie, could you please call the roll?
Representative Lindsey?
Yes.
Representative Nathanson?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Yes.
Chair Reed?
Aye.
Chair Vance?
Aye. House Bill 3029 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and we need a carrier, and I see Representative Huffman. Would you carry, Representative? Carry by Representative Huffman. Okay, with that, colleagues, I'm going to reopen the public hearing on HJM 22, and we have a number of folks that were unable to testify Monday. We're going to start with John. Well, before I do that, Zach, tell us about the bill.
The House Bill Memorial 22 urges federal government to fund the Columbia River Crossing Project.
And with that, John Mullis, John Little, and is it
Elena Guinea?
If they could come forward. Are they in the room? Coming through the door. No, they're not.
There's Elena.
Elena, do you?
Why isn't the hall? I get sometimes on my way in, but they're all.
Let me see why we're waiting. Well, why don't you go ahead, Elena, and if they come in, yay.
Thank you so much, Chair Benz, members of the committee. My name is Ilana Guinea. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. And I really appreciate the opportunity to explain briefly, watching the stoplight there, why this memorial is so important both to our 225,000 members across the state and to all middle-class Oregonians. The Columbia River Crossing Project has been a long time in the making. And contrary to what we may hear, there's been an extensive public process. In fact, I would guess that many of the people who have testified on this bill and will be testifying, the Oregon AFL-CIO included, have been involved in that process. We sincerely believe that we're at a critical place right now and that this is the time to act. Yes, there are still details to work out, but we have a good foundation for this project, and that's exactly where House Joint Memorial 22 comes in. It keeps the door open for further discussion, but it also points out agreed-upon elements in the project, and it sends clear messages to both our counterparts in Washington and to our delegation in Washington, D.C., that we are ready in Oregon to move forward on this project. I want to highlight some of the real benefits that this project will bring to our region's economic stability. You'll hear from others about the thousands of jobs this project will create in the short term right now when unemployment is in the double digits. But there are long-term benefits from the Columbia River Crossing project as well. Oregon's manufacturing economy is intimately tied to Washington's economy and to economies up and down the West Coast. High-wage workers in East Multnomah County manufacture Boeing parts that are then shipped to their campus in Washington for assembly up I-5. Wind turbines that fuel our clean energy farms and create jobs in eastern Oregon are shipped through the Port of Vancouver, brought across the river, and sent out along I-84. And thousands of Oregonians across our state work in manufacturing, creating goods that are shipped up and down I-5, while thousands more work to unload and transport goods that move in and out through our local ports and through and across our highways.
Elena, to avoid the trapdoor, you're going to have to wrap it up.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
Oregon's economy is dependent on I-5. If I-5 continues to be a traffic jam, we will continue to be at a competitive disadvantage. And House Joint Memorial 22 is the strong step forward we need to take now that still allows us to have important discussions as we move forward with the project. Thank you so much.
Thank you. John.
Good afternoon, Chair Vance, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is John Molas. I represent the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council, which is an umbrella organization for approximately 25,000 union construction workers in the state. Our council is a longtime member of the CRC Coalition, and I'm here today to testify in favor of House Joint Memorial 22. You've already heard much about the long process that this project has been through in order to get to this point. And I realize there are several very important decisions that will still need to be made, and I don't want to minimize any of these. But I believe it's time to move this House Joint Memorial forward and send a message that we're ready to build this bridge. I would like to speak briefly to the human impacts of why I believe it's time to move forward. Everyone is aware of the very difficult economy that we've all been through the past 2.5 years. The building trades have probably been hit the hardest. Our members have been unemployed on average at rates of approximately 35% for the past 2+ years. Some of the locals have had their members unemployed at rates as high as 60%. And if you look at our underemployed members, members that are working a day or two a week, or maybe every other week, we're probably approaching 60 to 70%. These aren't statistics. These are real people with real families and real mortgages and other bills to pay. We have members, and I know some of them personally, who have lost their health insurance, their vehicles, their homes, their marriages, everything they've worked their entire lives to build up. So we support the governor and his leadership to move this project forward. The project will create much-needed jobs for the building trades now, but that's not the only reason we support it. We support it for the regional economic development that it will bring. This isn't just about jobs now. It's jobs in the future. As our economy recovers and businesses begin to make decisions on if they're going to grow their businesses here or possibly locate a business here, we want them to be able to do so right here with the confidence that they'll be able to get their goods and services to market in a timely fashion so that our children and grandchildren can enjoy a vibrant economy and live here and stay here. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. If you have any questions, I'll do my best.
Thank you, John. Are there questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And knowing that we have an issue with time, I'm going to make my question real short and then ask if your answer could be just a simple yes or no or 20 seconds. And if it's something longer, maybe you could just come talk to me. The question is, my point is the idea of jobs now sounds really great. A lot of Oregonians need work. But there are questions about, is this the right bridge? And, of course, this project isn't just a bridge. It's a series of many projects. The bridge is apparently a smaller proportion. It's less than half of what the money would be spent on. Lots of jobs and projects elsewhere, like on interchanges. It looks like a bunch of the work is going to be done in Washington, not in Oregon. So more activity there. If the project were to change and say, well, instead of this interchange, let's fix this one instead, or instead of the bridge being right here, maybe it should be right there, If your interest is primarily in solving economic problems for the state and in jobs, would you support the project if it changed a little bit, like the bridge should look like this, or the other piece of what needs to be fixed is there? Would you still support that?
Chair Benz, Representative Nathanson, I think that one of the main things that we're looking at is making sure that we move this project forward quickly. There is a lot of room within House Joint Memorial 22 for slight changes. It talks about some of the aspects of the bridge, but not specifically what the bridge will look like. There aren't blueprints for the bridge in the memorial. It's pretty open still. But we do think that we need to be moving forward on this project quickly, both for those short-term economic development issues and the long-term ability of our state to continue to develop. I'm happy to talk to you about it more in your office, though.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did you have something to
add? Chair Benz, Representative Nathanson, I would be happy to meet with you and Alana as well. And I think we will have another speaker behind us that will speak to the number of interchanges and the work that's proposed in Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just a question for someone who might have an answer next time. Columbia River Crossing Project in HJM 22 is capitalized as if it's a defined term. I see no definition of that term. If someone could address that at some point, that would be very helpful.
Either one of you, okay.
Chair, I believe that will happen.
Okay. Chair Benz, Representative yes. Lindsay, there are further people coming who will address okay. that, I believe.
Further questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'd like to call up Dan McFarlane, Ron Swearin, and Sharon Nassett. Are all three of those? There's two. There's three. And then after this panel is finished, we're going to open the hearing for one witness on the helmet bill so that Representative Freeman doesn't have to wait any longer. This will be another opportunity to keep your testimony succinct so that he doesn't become... he's not going to. So, please, who would like to go first?
Chairs Benson and Reed, R-E-A-D, Reed.
Thank you.
My name is Dan. Is the microphone on? My name is Dan McFarlane. There is a bulldozer in town. This is not a how do we cross the Columbia River project. It is a tear down and rebuild several miles of freeway project. This project not only fails to exist, not only fails to address many of the fundamental problems with the existing infrastructure, it actually continues them. It wastes money Oregon can ill afford to waste, money that is funding that bulldozer. $4 billion, probably closer to 10, destroying sound infrastructure at a time when crumbling bridges, roads, and other infrastructure really needs our attention. The giant sucking sound places future transportation dollars in a lockbox. I urge you to look at the common sense alternative presented by George Crandall on Monday. It is the result of many concerned Oregonians who do not have their fingers in the cookie jar. On Monday, you heard many testify that we need to move forward. We do. We need jobs. We need to enable, we need to fix the waterways so that Oregon wheat can more easily move down the river. Look at the common sense alternative. By dramatically reducing bridge lifts, it reduces congestion in the near term, improving waterway and rail at the same time. It costs less. It can be phased. It addresses needs of all modes of transportation, including high-speed rail. It gets local traffic off the interstate. It does not interfere with the nearby airport. It does not alienate Northeast Portland neighborhoods. It does not suck up transportation dollars needed elsewhere in the state. It is a 21st century solution. It is time to stop the funding. It is time to stop encouraging the bulldozer. Please vote no. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, chairs and committee members. My name is Ron Swore, and I live in Portland. I'd like to ask you to vote no on this HJM 22. The legislature is going to be approached by a lot of people that have plans that are supposed to promote economic development. I know Metro has some other plans for transportation that are very expensive, somewhat comparable to the Columbia River Crossing. And I'm sure you're approached by other communities in Oregon that have plans for economic development. So somehow decisions have to be made as to what are the most important needs. In this case, we have a bridge that's functioning very well. We even have less than what comparable cities have that are in our situation. Cincinnati, for example, has 4 interstate bridges. St. Louis has 12 over the Missouri and Mississippi River. Philadelphia has 7 over the Delaware River. So what I'd like to ask from a planning standpoint is, how is it defensible for a major metropolitan area to be limited to 2 bridges, which is what would happen if I-5 was torn down and replaced with another, because we wouldn't have enough money for the other projects that we need. We need a third interstate bridge. I've handed out a page with this map. This is from Metro, showing how the Portland area has grown. The 1960 drawing shows a lot of expansion on the east side, and so I-205 was built to accommodate that expansion and served very well. But the projections, if you look ahead to 2040, Metro is projecting a huge increase and continued increase out in Washington County. So it's really time that the needs for transportation infrastructure in Washington County be addressed. So I really believe that it's time for a third bridge that connects major U.S. highways and connects the Portland area to Clark County. Clark County residents are bringing $150 million a year currently into Oregon revenue because of their employment in Oregon, so they deserve something. And we can meet the mass transit needs through more cost-effective means. Here's some photos of double-decker buses in London that move a lot of people. So there's ways of meeting those needs without spending billions of dollars. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Sharon Nassett. Thank you, Chair Benz, and thank you, Chair Reed, and thank you for holding over the hearing. Very gracious. I am with ThirdBridgeNow.com. I have been involved in this process for 10 years. I was involved in the I-5 Trade and Transportation Partnership, bringing in a project that was recommended for further study, as well as representing the North Portland Business Association, and was the chair of the Business Association for about 4 years. I brought a letter the other day from the Southwest Washington Regional Transportation Council and the Clark County Commissioners that stated our project, the Third Bridge Corridor, was not studied, was not vetted. However, it was brought in during the NEPA process, and it was removed. I have brought you some letters today from representatives, 13 elected officials in Washington, that stated it is very important, if you want the stakeholders to be involved in this process, to have studied the port-to-port. Any bridge that is built will bring us jobs. The port-to-port connection is often what is the third bridge is called. It is a brand-new mini-freeway that connects I-5 to the Port of Vancouver, Rivergate, and the Northwest Industrial Areas, removing traffic from neighborhoods and from the I-5 corridor. Previous studies that are similar to this of an arterial have been recommended for further study in 3 other studies, and we have done, at great expense of our own, a benefit analysis, which is this book that is with you today. It is Shekhar Jewell. We went out of the area. It was very hard to get an engineering firm locally. The previous studies all stated that we needed more infrastructure, rail, roads, and bridges. Our current bridge is structurally sufficient, meets all requirements, has 50 years of sustainable life at $3 million a year maintenance and operations. There is no reason to remove that. The on and off ramps that they are considering doing, the majority of them are to reach the bridge, which will now be 90 feet in the air. Several of the non-conforming issues that they are talking about with that bridge take place on the Markham Bridge and throughout the I-5 freeway. The I-5 freeway was deemed to be full by the states of Oregon and Washington legislations in the 1980s. Putting a bridge in the center of it will only send thousands of more cars into our neighborhood, which is why none of the environmental groups or the Northeast Coalition support it. Thank you, and please support a supplemental EIS. It is needed.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel?
Please.
See no questions. Thank you very much.
I'd also like to note that Ms. Nassif did drop off a document which will be available online to the members.
Thank you.
The next panel is David Sweet, Joe Courtright, and John Charles. And again, Representative, you're okay with waiting?
I just didn't want to go with the rest of
us. Okay. Thank you.
Ride the herd.
Who'd like to go first?
Chair Benz, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is David Sweet. I represent the Northeast Coalition of Neighborhoods, 12 neighborhoods in Inner North and Northeast Portland. Our neighborhoods are heavily impacted by Interstate 5 and would be further impacted by the proposed freeway expansion that is the Columbia River Crossing. Like many who have testified, we would like to see a solution to I-5 congestion. This is not it. While temporarily relieving some of the congestion near the Columbia, and especially in Vancouver, Washington, the CRC will only add to the existing congestion south of the project in the neighborhoods that we represent. This will increase the high levels of air pollution in North Portland neighborhoods, which already experience an unacceptably high level of asthma, twice the national average. It will also add traffic to our neighborhood streets because people are going to leave the freeway to avoid the congestion that is already bad at the Rose Quarter. The Northeast Coalition has held two community forums on the CRC to present this project to our neighbors and receive their feedback. At the more recent of these, earlier this month, 150 attendees packed a lecture hall and were overwhelmingly opposed to the CRC project as it's currently conceived. We are confident that we represent the consensus of our community in opposing this project. I appreciate the time and attention this committee has given to this memorial. While apparently symbolic, it could be seen as a way to gain legislative approval for the CRC while avoiding the more difficult debate about funding this freeway project. With over $100 million already spent and no end in sight, I hope to see the legislature step up and rein in the CRC rather than writing it a blank check. We urge you not to support this project that primarily benefits Washington commuters at our expense, that will have a huge negative impact on the health and vitality of Inner North Northeast Portland neighborhoods, that is ill-conceived and poorly researched. There are better ways to reduce congestion, there are better ways to move freight, and there are certainly better ways to create jobs for Oregonians.
Thank you, Mr. Sweet. Charles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute, and I've been involved with this for over 10 years, going back to the I-5 trade partnership days. I have testified before the CRC Project Council and its many prior iterations quite a few times. And I was very happy to hear Ms. Nassif and several of the witnesses in the last 10 minutes finally get to the crux of the problem, which is that arguing about the little minutiae of this project kind of misses the point. It is conceptually doomed to fail because it's a mega bridge. There seems to be this operating theory that we should only, now and forever, have only two crossings over the river. Well, trying to funnel all that traffic there without any understanding of how it affects the rest of the highway system, which is already overloaded many times during weekdays, means it's not going to work. And if we think that the two crossings is all we need, then I suggest we just go down a little south to downtown Portland. We have two interstate crossings over that river, Fremont Markham Bridge. So we have eight other arterial bridges. Let's tear those out, and then we'll be just like our Columbia River system. Well, of course, nobody would propose that because it's such a dumb idea. All those arterial bridges are already at or over capacity most of the time. They're extremely important, and by having them, you reduce driving by all the out of the way driving you have to get to get to a bridge. So this whole notion of a mega bridge, regardless of things, bells and whistles about it, is not going to work. You know, Pittsburgh is a comparably sized city with rivers, and they have 29 bridge crossings. Only six are interstates. The best strategy would be to upgrade this bridge pretty cheaply, as Mr. Cordwright suggested a couple days ago, and then add not just one, two or three arterial bridges down in Gresham. But especially, we have to get west side Beaverton-Hillsborough traffic off of 26, off of 405, Fremont Bridge, I-5, get another route down to 30, over, then you solve multiple problems. And finally, the light rail project has to go. $321 million per mile? Are you kidding me? The L line up to that point only costs $60 million a mile. Rubber-tired, road-based transit works great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Charles. Mr. Cordwright.
Chair Bence, members of the committee, I'm appearing today on behalf of Bob Stacey, who signed up on Monday and was unable to attend. You have his written testimony, and I'll summarize that for you briefly. Bob first points out that this resolution essentially puts the cart before the horse. We're not in a position to ask the federal government for money when we haven't even decided as a state whether we have the money to fund this project. And you should know that in its financial plan, the CRC has promised the federal government that Oregon would make $450 million commitment to this project by July of this year. That was in the application to the Federal Transit Administration as a key part of the project. So this is a hollow ask without that commitment. Bob further points out that we do not have $450 million available in the transportation budget, and without an increase in gas taxes or serious cuts to the remainder of the programmed investments that we have throughout the state, there's no way to come up with $450 million. So our position is incredible. As the independent review panel pointed out, it's really important that this project be broken down into phases, and that hasn't been done. You've basically been presented with a giant all-or-nothing project, and Bob's point is all-or-nothing really risks nothing. And what the independent review panel said was, unless it's phased, this project is unmanageable and maybe unaffordable. So in the effort to do the big ask, you may doom this project to failure for more reasons than my colleagues have just pointed out. And the final point that Bob wanted me to make was these bridges are, in fact, structurally sound. And don't take my word for it. Take ODOT's word for it. They prepare a report each year. They identify the soundness of every bridge on the interstate system. The two interstate bridges are listed as structurally sound. The Markham Bridge is not listed as structurally sound. It is structurally unsound. So if you're concerned about seismic issues, there are 25 other bridges on the interstate system in Oregon that are structurally unsound. These two bridges are not. Doesn't make sense to tear them down and spend all that money there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cordwright, and thank you for staying within the time limits. Are there questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So I want to ask about the couple questions to start with you. When I was first pitched on this project by friends of mine who I respect a lot, I was told that the local neighborhood association supported the project. This was 2-3 years ago. I learned about your testimony. I learned about the decision that you guys made somewhat recently. Was I wrongly informed before, or did something change? And if something changed, what changed?
Nothing changed, Chair Benz, Representative Smith. Nothing changed for the Northeast Coalition of Neighborhoods. The first stand we took on the project was about 14 months ago after the first public forum that we held. And at that time, we took a position in opposition to the CRC. There may be other neighborhoods along the Columbia, but I don't know about their support for it.
You follow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it was before 14 months ago, so I don't think I was told a falsehood, but now I understand the timeline a little better. Joe, question for you. I want to talk about the DOE. Talk about investment grade analysis, why it's important. And I do think it's important. I mean, so far we have, and I don't like talking about any of this stuff. I don't like challenging any of this stuff. It's way easier to let it go. My concern is I have seen, forgive this comment, Mr. Chair, I have seen people who held the conch feel that it was so hot to the touch they wanted to pass it quickly. And I'm glad we're coming to grips with it, and I hope that before we move a resolution will come to grips with it and maybe with a meaningful bill with sideboards and really get to the heart of the matter. But I know that in the onward sweep, we had an EIS statement that flunked the Bush administration's EPA. We know we were told last year and up to January that we could do an open web design, that would work, and then the independent review panel told us it wouldn't. Talk about the DOE, talk about investment grade analysis. It seems like the kind of thing we'd want to do now rather than the thing we'd want to do later, and that's what I know about that.
Mr. Chair and Representative
just
Smith,
if I may, if you could answer very, very short.
Very, very brief.
Thank you.
This project contemplates borrowing at least $1.4 billion. Before Wall Street will lend you that money, they will insist on the preparation of something called an investment-grade analysis, which is an independent review of all the financial projections. The independent review panel said that needed to be done, and it hasn't been done. And you should really have that same information in your hands before you commit any of your money in the same way that Wall Street will want that information before it commits its money.
Thanks.
Further questions? Thank you so much.
Sure.
We have a final panel, Josephine Wenzel, Joe Smith, and Sue Marshall. Sue Marshall subbing in for Evan Mandel. Who would like to go first?
Hello, my name is Josephine Wenzel. I'm from Vancouver, Washington, and I'm here to urge you to vote no on this. And the reason being is citizens of Vancouver, Washington, is not happy with this project. You hear a lot from CRC talk about how they've done public outreach. If you look at the actual videos of the public outreach, you would see the outrage of citizens saying, we don't want this. We don't have the ridership, nor do we have the density in little town Vancouver to have light rail, which is one-third of this project, is the cost of this project here. You hear a lot about jobs, but my question is, after these union workers are done with their five-year work, how are they going to afford tolls after that? Taxpayers shouldn't be held hostage to create jobs. It's not our responsibility. And just because of the economy, and you hear people say, because of the economy, lack of jobs, that's the very reason we shouldn't proceed with this project right now. Vancouver residents are facing one of the highest unemployment in Washington State. They're losing their homes left and right. And there's a lot of problems over there. We can't afford this. We don't want this. We've made our statements. When elected officials in Washington have to form a political action committee and contribute money to it to come against the citizens, there is a problem with the system. I'm urging you to please reconsider this. Don't fall prey to going along with their project. Woodland City Council, even though they were bribed by a representative, and this was in the newspaper, had came forth and said, no, we are not going to support this project. They voted 4-1. And I'm urging you, please look at everything, listen and examine, and listen to the people. As far as neighborhood associations, you hear a lot of that. The neighborhoods are for it, the business are for it. I represent a large business in Vancouver, and we are against it like many businesses are. You just don't hear us because the people who have your ears are the ones that have the voice with the newspaper or whatever. But listen to the people. We don't want it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We won't hold against you the fact you're from Washington. Who's?
I will.
Well, you. I'm sorry.
I hold it.
I speak only for myself. who's? Who'd like to be next?
Yes, I would. Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chairs Benson Reed. My name is Mara Gross. Rather than Sue Marshall, I am testifying on behalf of Evan Manvel, who was unable to return to testify today. Mr. Manvel is a resident of Northeast Portland, has a master's degree in public policy and urban planning, and has been working in the field for 2 decades. Mr. Manvel submitted testimony in writing, so I'll simply share highlights. At Monday's hearing, CRC proponents brought up the seismic issue. While Mr. Manvel is not a seismic expert, ODOT's 2010 bridge condition report is accessible to any reader. And as Mr. Cortright said, the report indicates that there are 117 structurally deficient bridges in Oregon, and 25 of them are on interstates. The I-5 spans over the Columbia River are not among them. The Markham Bridge, I-5, over the in the center of Portland is, and there's no plan to seismically retrofit the Markham Bridge. In addition, ODOT's seismic vulnerability report finds the highest potential loss in an earthquake would be on Highway 101. That same report found, quote, current available highway funding is inadequate to achieve a minimum standard of seismic safety, even on the interstate and other critical routes, and we'd be happy to provide these materials to you. It would be smarter from a seismic perspective to take the $450 million or more from ODOT's limited coffers for seismic upgrades to key facilities around the state. We could also reinforce the existing I-5 spans over the Columbia River for pennies on the dollar. Of the CRC mega project. So, in sum, for Mr. Manvel, it says spending billions to focus on the wrong seismic solution is not the best use of state dollars. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Smith.
Joe Smith speaking for myself. Everyone here agrees on three things. Freight transit is critically important. We have a bottleneck that must be fixed, which also must include seismic protection and fixing it so barge passages don't stop traffic. Tolls will be part of any solution. The cause of the problem can be stated two ways. One, the existing crossings are inadequate for the traffic, or two, the current traffic is too heavy for the crossings. Unfortunately, the juggernaut pushing this hugely expensive project embedded in this memorial word the problem only number one, and thus ignore the problem's root cause, which is thousands of commuters every day, almost all traveling solo. What if we could cut commuters in half, solo commuters in half, and in a year or so have a crossing that expedites freight and mass transit? That can happen. How? By addressing root cause with a carrot and a stick. The carrot, a robust clearinghouse using today's technology, helping commuters carpool. The stick, graduated rush hour tolls, traveling solo, pretty hefty. Two of you, modest. Three in the car, small or even free. That can be done not in years, but months. Then approve now the kind of fix described Monday by George Crandall. This offers what's really needed, action now, and addresses root cause. Let's learn from I-205. When built, never a delay. Today, stop and go every rush hour. Why? It encourages solo commuting. Get rid of solo commuting to solve the problem. That's the root cause. We can be smarter.
Thank you very much. And do we have questions for this panel?
Who's that guy?
Other than that one.
And for the record, he did not know I was going to be here.
Darn right. Although, Mr. Chair, he might have recognized
that good
the pattern from Monday.
He might have. Well, thank you very much, panel, and seeing no questions, we do have, that finishes our signed-up testimony. We do have an invited witness, Patricia McKay, if she would come up and explain who you are, and maybe you'd like to respond to some of what you've heard. And what we're going to do, there's quite a few issues, but if you could keep your remarks in the 5-6 minute range, we would appreciate it, because I'm sure there are going to be some questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Patricia McKay with the Columbia River Crossing, and if I start to address the questions that aren't as relevant, direct me the other way and I'll hit those. A couple of quick comments from the last...
Before, could you explain again who you are, who you're appearing for, what your background is?
Certainly. My name is Patricia McKay. I am a subcontractor. I work with the Columbia River Crossing for the directors and for the governor.
Which one?
Well, actually, almost both, but directly Governor Kitzhaber.
Okay, thank you.
The project is a joint project between Oregon and Washington, two directors, and the governors are responsible for the projects. In that capacity, I respond to both. A couple of quick comments. First, I'd like to set the context for the discussion. I think most importantly out of last week or earlier this week's conversation, there were questions raised about what I would describe as the fairness or the balance. I think Representative Nathanson raised those questions and asked specifically about the interchanges and the, again, the balance between the two states. So if I can spend 2 seconds, maybe 2 minutes, on describing that, if that's helpful now. Remember, it is roughly a five-mile project. In terms of thinking about it, there's more or less 3 miles on the Washington side. About a half a mile takes up the bridge, and there's a little less than 2 miles on the Oregon side. In the 3 miles that's on the Washington side, there are a total of 5 interchanges. We've phased out one of those interchanges, so the cost associated with those 4 remaining interchanges that are part of the project on the Washington side is about $750 million in year of expenditure dollars. Right? On the Oregon side, in that 2 and some miles, we have only 2 interchanges. And those 2 interchanges, because of their complexity and the needs that they meet and their age and a variety of things, cost almost $1 billion. The cost of, yeah. So on the Oregon side, about $1 billion for the interchanges. On the Washington side, $760 million or something. The other costs, whether it's the bridge or light rail or the demolition of the bridge that already exists, are all basically shared costs. But if you're looking for proportionality in all of that, there actually is some. In addition to that, I think it's the dilemma and the challenge that has faced this project from its very beginning, which is working with 2 different states, 2 different communities, 2 different transit districts, and assuring that there is, for everyone involved, from the mayor of Vancouver to the mayor of Portland, a fairness and equity about the way they are spending the dollars and the products and the benefits that the project will bring to their constituencies. And I think we have a balanced project that the Project Sponsor Council and the local governments believe does that. The final thing I'd say about the way the bridge and the project is distributed is it is really important for the Oregon side to remember that we're going to have tolls on the Washington side and that a majority of the people who are coming over are going to be paying those tolls, and they're paying in large part to help expand the bridge. So that was one element that I thought might be helpful. The second piece that I wanted to address was the questions that were raised as a result of, I believe, a report that was done by Joe Courtwright that has been, I think, delivered to the committee, 3 specific questions. And these questions came from a series of legislators. And all I can tell you is how much the project wants to engage in these conversations with all of you about these kinds of topics. We will never be done answering the question about what does this project cost, how is it being managed, what the accountability elements are, what the oversight is, whether the travel forecasting is right, and how we're handling the cost overruns. We have to have those conversations frequently and ongoing with the committee and other committees in the legislature now. I would say, as it relates to these specific questions and the report that is attached to those questions, that they have been reviewed and they have been analyzed and they have been vetted and they have been dismissed. And let me quickly answer the questions. The first one is the cost of the project, and I think it said the true cost of the project. Washington State has an extraordinary system, and remember that it is in no one's best interest to not do diligent, thoughtful, rigorous, and conservative work looking at these numbers. It's in no one's. We all want that kind of application of thoughtfulness about it. There is a cost estimating validation process called CVIP from Washington that is a nationally known model that is applied to the Columbia River crossing, and we will spend as much time as you'd like to go through that with you. We will summarize it by saying that the independent review panel, as well as the Project Sponsor Council and the local governments, have all accepted the premises and the work from this process, which is updated yearly, and it concludes that the cost of the project is estimated today, based on the information that we have, and remember there are still a lot of decisions to be made, that the cost is between $3.2 and $3.6 billion. The report that is referenced in the letter, it says that the cost is going to be $10 billion. There are fundamental flaws inherent in that conclusion. And one of them is that the $10 billion includes what the consultant would say are adjacent or supplemental projects. It would be the same as if you were going to remodel your kitchen, and as you put that price together to remodel your kitchen, you decided to add on the roof and the neighbor's garage because you saw it out the window. That is the level of supplemental projects that have been added into the conclusion that the project is going to is actually going to cost $10 billion. Specifically, one of those, and I know this has been referenced in your material, is the I-84 Rose Quarter, and whether we are moving a problem downstream. And is this relevant, Mr. Chair? Should I keep going?
Well, I think if you could, it's all of us relevant.
Okay.
And I'd like to hear a lot more. We just don't have enough time. What I'd like to do is kind of wrap up what you think is most important, and then we're going to see if the committee has questions, because I'm sure they do. And then, sadly, we're
great.
Going to...
I'll finish with the Rose Quarter in two pieces, and I'll be done.
Thanks.
The Rose Quarter, because I know it comes up whether we're moving. The Rose Quarter is about 5 miles from Marine Drive. So it's 5 miles really outside of the project area, just for the record. In addition to that, our travel forecasting has indicated that we are not going to make it worse, and we're not going to make it better. We are not pushing the traffic downstream. We are not making it a more congested interchange than it already is, and it is already listed as one of the projects that needs to be addressed, just as Terwilliger Curves is right after it. The investment grade analysis is absolutely essential. There is no one who has not thought that the investment grade analysis is important and necessary. The reality is that for its value to be applied in the investment community, it usually is done 6 to 12 months before the bonds are actually issued. It is way premature to be able to begin to do that kind of process. And if you chose to do it, we can pay to do it. We'll have to pay to do it again. And maybe that will give some comfort to folks, but it is not a timely nor prudent thing to do at this point in time. It is absolutely essential for the project to do it ultimately. And finally, about the cost overruns, again, it is in no one's interest not to be as rigorous in looking at schedule and risks as humanly possible to deliver a project on budget and on time. And that has been the focus of the process and the project. And we believe that we are in better shape than most projects to be able to give you the clearest analysis of what it will take to do that and what the risks are to date. And the independent review panel confirmed and validated all of our work to date. They did not, in fact, after hearing the same report, decide to direct the project to do anything differently or conduct its work differently.
Thank you. Thank you for that summary, and I wish we had another 2 hours for this purpose. Questions? Co-chair, me first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McKeag, I wonder if you could give us a little bit more of your analysis and description of the project as it relates to the relationship with the federal government and how our efforts here contribute to that. The discussion we're having here is part of that process, I imagine.
Thank you. I'd love to. As you know, right after the governor was elected, he went back and visited Secretary LaHood about the Columbia River crossing. And all of us, myself included from my earlier work in government, we've all been aware of the congestion problem and the struggle that we face in fixing that transportation bottleneck on the I-5 corridor, which is not just safety as it relates to seismic, it's safety as it relates to accidents, and that is a really important component of this proposal. We found that through the work both of our congressional delegation here in Oregon and our congressional delegation in Washington, that the Columbia River crossing, because of the unique nature of the project, the intermodal, the opportunity to have light rail, bike head, and highway together, has put it in a very well-viewed position for funding from the federal government. And Secretary LaHood requested that the governors come back and do further conversations with him, and that's occurred, and I think you've seen the press comments that he is optimistic that if we are able to move forward with a project, that it would be eligible for both federal funds from the Highway Department and the Transit Agency.
Thank you. Representative Sheehan.
There's been some testimony that this has cost between $100 and $130 million so far. How much of that was coming from the people of Oregon?
We've spent $120 million to date, and right now, of the money, there's federal funds from Oregon, federal funds from Washington, state funds from Oregon, and state funds from Washington. And if you tally it all up, Washington has put in about $13 million more than Oregon. The rest of it's equally split. So I can give you the actual numbers, but it's pretty evenly split except for that $13 million.
And quick follow-up,
please.
Among that, recognizing that this involves a ton of different government agencies
right.
and a ton of people coming together, about how much of that 50 or 60 million bucks was spent on lobbying and government affairs?
You know, one, we don't have lobbyists. Two, we have public outreach and communication strategies.
I guess we have a new title.
The light of the day.
Let's go with that number, then.
As I think is evidence, and I don't know whether you're meaning in Salem, but, you know, are you talking about Salem?
I'm talking about dollars that went to somebody to go talk to a public official or the public.
Sure. Out of $120 million, and I'll get you some figure, I bet it's less than $4 million, $3 million, $2 million. It's not.
It's 4, 3, or 2.
I mean, I genuinely don't know, but
okay.
It's not substantial parts for the project.
Okay.
Design and engineering, I think, is about $40 million. Environmental permitting, I mean, that's where the real money is in
okay.
this project.
Thank you.
Representative Weiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two quick questions. First, is the third bridge option even been looked at? Because, I mean, when I'm looking at this, it seems like a boondoggle to me. When we're just looking at replacing a bridge that already exists and it's not really solving the traffic problem. So has the third bridge option even been explored or looked at?
Yes, it has been looked at. And I think the more important point I would make is that we do believe that we're solving substantial problems, reducing congestion by bringing light rail and improving safety. As people go back and forth, not just the seismic safety, but you may have missed the presentation on Monday, but there are roughly 400 crashes a year, almost a crash a day, and that is a lot of what contributes to the congestion on the bridge. Right now, it's somewhere between 5 and 6 hours a day in congestion, and in 2030, if we don't do anything, we're going to have 15 hours of congestion on the bridge, and that's in real time and real money. So we started with 70 different ideas initially, not we, I wasn't part of that, but 70 different ideas and narrowed it down to 12, then to 5, and then finally to this one. And then included on all of that were many of these alternatives that you're hearing about today, but they didn't get momentum in the different public venues to move forward. There wasn't support for them to move forward. It's not the project that made that happen. It was a whole series of different things. So that what you have in front of you today is a consensus among a lot of different task force and local elected officials and their governments.
And you had a second question. If you could keep your answer, we have a number of other representatives right. waiting for the next item. Did you have a question, Representative Smith? Please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So heard in the testimony today and before, excuse me, Patricia, and I will say for the record and off the record, I have tremendous respect for your work now and in the future and before.
That's your dad.
Say again?
You didn't say that to your dad.
You guys are different people. no, I love my dad, respect him as well, but I knew you were testifying. I didn't. I've heard that we have a set of seismically unsafe and structurally unsound bridges around Oregon, including on the interstate system, that we and recently had a Japan earthquake, which obviously is after planning and activity around this project was begun. I know there's 50, you know, the president's talked about $53 billion for high-speed rail. In our conversations with LaHood and with the feds, do we have major requests to address those two things, for high-speed rail, which I know isn't part of this project, and so that's some critique of some folks, and seismic retrofits for our bridges around the state. Do we have requests for those two things?
Mr. Chair, Jeff, Representative Smith, I don't know the answer to that, and there are people in the room who do.
Thanks.
Sorry.
Thank
you. Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here today. So as I've gone through this piecemeal here, I've gone through every whereas. There's 12 whereases, and of the 12 whereases, there's 9 definition or embeddings of Columbia River Crossing Project. My concern is that it's defined nowhere, and it seems that that's a huge, broadly defined term that could be that anything could be shoved in under the hood on that term. Is there a way that we can more narrowly define the project?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Lindsay, there is a definition for the Columbia River Crossing Project, which is that 5.5-mile set, 7 interchanges, replacement bridge with light rail and bike ped facility. That's sort of the general description of it. And maybe that would be helpful if we pull that out and put that in the House Joint Memorial. Is that what you're looking for?
Well, I was just trying to get something on the record of defining the project. I think that's helpful. It still seems pretty broad, but just for me personally, it seems like a lot of things could be shoved in under the hood under that term.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lindsay, we have the actual interchanges. We can call them out if that's helpful and talk about the replacement bridge and the light rail and the bike and ped if that helps fill it out for you.
Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Members of the committee, I think my co-chair and I are in agreement that this matter needs to come back before this committee. Is that,
we are.
Catching that correctly. And I suspect strongly that we'll see some amendments, maybe a number of them. And we don't have that many $3.5 billion bills before us, so this is worthy of some more review. And with that, I'll close the public hearing on HJM 22. And open a public hearing and possible work session on HB 3596. And we have, I hope,
Representative
Krieger here. And do we have
Speaker Roblin?
Speaker Roblin.
He had to leave. I don't know if he's coming back. I think he will.
Okay, and this, since Zach is out looking, why don't you, Representative, you go ahead? I know you have a committee. This is the bill that would empower the Oregon International Port of Coos Bay to own and operate a rail line connecting the station of Daneville in Lane County to the station of Coquille in Coos County.
Okay. Thank you, co-chairs. For the record, my name is Wayne Krieger, State Representative of District 1. And I think the history beyond this bill itself is the fact that Democrats and Republicans for several sessions have worked to purchase the rail line, the Port of Coos Bay, to be able to purchase it, all recognizing how important it is to the entire South Coast. It's not just Coos Bay. It's all of Coos County, Curry County, Douglas County, and on up the coast to have that port as a viable resource for economic development in the future, because I really believe that. And it's been good for me to go back and forth as I go down Poodle Creek and on down the Siuslaw to see that being maintained, the brush being coming off, and seeing it getting back into condition for its opening in the not-too-distant future. This bill really, if you get it down to what it really says, yes, it's the Coos Bay line owning it, I mean the port owning it, but it does say the port may own, operate, repair, and maintain the Coos Bay rail line. And really, that's what they need to be able to do to serve the communities and drive the economy on the coast. And I think it's a great opportunity. I don't know anyone who objects to it. And you'll see legislators, regardless of party affiliation, here today supporting it. And I sure hope that you will move the bill.
Thank you very much. Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. For the record, Arnie Roblin, represented from District 9, which is Coos Bay to Florence, which is the starting part. Actually, it starts, if you go all the way to the end of the line, in Representative Krieger's district, so it was good that he was first in Coquille, and then moves through Coos Bay and on. And, you know, the legislature has been extremely helpful over the last few years in helping us obtain this line, and now we're about ready to operate. And to do that and to do it effectively, this bill is, we hope, the last part of that. I want to also commend, I don't know if Representative Krieger was mentioned it, but Susan Morgan, a previous legislator here, began a group called the Southern Oregon Transportation Work Group, of which both of us were members. And as they were working on this, on all the projects for the Southwest Oregon, from the California border basically up to Eugene, over and over again, the Port of Coos Bay and this railroad became number one priorities for that group. And we have appreciated the support of all of the legislators and the people in that corridor as well because of the economic development. This is a jobs bill, simply. It is allowing us to run the rail that we have now are getting in position to be able to actually move it up to a faster class railroad, which means that we can actually move the products that are coming. We have a new business in Coos Bay, which will be sending commercial-grade sand for foundries across the country. We need to finish that up by having this bill passed, and I appreciate Representative Krieger and all of the others. If you look at the people on the list who are co-sponsors of this bill, they are all the representatives that are on the line. So I think it's one of those things we all understand the need for, and I thank you for your opportunity to speak to you. And we both stand ready to answer any questions you might have.
Questions for this panel? Yes, Professor Widener.
I look for the opportunity to support my speaker anytime I get the chance to, and I
appreciate
thank you
that.
For bringing this bill to us.
Well, thank you.
Mr. Speaker, he is learning.
Yeah, he is, slowly.
Yeah, no, I'm kidding.
Further questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a fairly simple question, just bears out my relative ignorance on the subject, but it looks like in reading the bill, it's just making more specific that it's the Port of Coos Bay as opposed to the port. Could you speak to that?
And we have some other experts here, and I'll give it my best shot. The issue is that ports have jurisdictions for their port districts, and this will go through multiple port districts to get to Eugene. The port already owns the line, but to operate it, it needs to have clarification that it can operate the line. That's my simplest way of putting that. So this actually allows them to operate the line, its full length, through other port districts.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Further questions? See none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have three people signed up, but I'm just wondering if Martin Callery, is Martin here? It's Martin. And then we also have Sharon Nassett and Gerald Fox, but I'm wondering if they signed up incorrectly. No? Are they gone? Okay, we just have then Martin Callery signed up on this bill.
Chair Benz, Chair Reed, members of the committee, I'm Martin Callery. I'm Chief Commercial Officer for the Oregon International Port of Coos Bay. I think you've heard from Representative Krieger and Representative Roblin what the purpose of this is. We simply want to be able to include the rail corridor in the port district so that we can utilize our economic development activities and access to bonding and things like that within that same corridor. Implement port ordinance as anything. We were asked by a representative of Oregon counties if there would be any economic impact to counties. Absolutely not. In fact, in the long term, if we were able to utilize our abilities to do economic development and new businesses were located along the line in another county or another community, that would actually be a benefit and that would create additional tax revenue on the property tax rolls.
Thank you.
Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that. Are there questions, Mr. Keller? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And colleagues, I think we're ready to work this bill. Am I correct, Zach? Do we have everything we need to work this bill today?
No, we don't.
We don't, so we can't. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 3596. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2468. And I think Zach, tell us what that bill is.
House Bill 2468 removes the sunset on provisions that establish requirements, unless the parties agree otherwise, for motor vehicle liability arbitration proceedings regarding uninsured motorist coverage.
We have two people, I think, that want to testify on this. If they could come up, one from State Farm and one from OLA. Sorry, gentlemen, I forgot to write down your names.
Neil Jackson, I know from OTLA.
Do the first name.
Burrell, am I right?
If you could keep your testimony fairly to the point, very much appreciate it.
Neil Jack from OTLA. I'm on the Board of Governors. I've spoken to all of the representatives here, except I believe Co-Chair Sheehan. We did speak to his L.A. this week. We hope this committee understands the bill. It's a consensus bill. Simply removes the sunset provision from the private arbitration rules that we have operated under for the last 4 years. We feel it's worked well. We've all played nice together. We'd like the sunset removed so we can continue to function the way we have.
And that's you're speaking for the Trial Lawyers Association.
For the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association.
Okay. And Mr. Merle.
Chair Vance, Co-Chair Vance, and Co-Chair Reed, Steve Merle with State Farm Insurance for the record. Mr.
Jackson
has stated this correctly. This was a consensus bill we worked on several years ago because of concerns of the impact, particularly my experience in my practice in Washington. We asked to have a sunset put in. The problems have not materialized, and so we're okay with the sunset being removed and the bill being reenacted going forward. If we have problems, I'll talk to Mr. Jackson to see if he can bring his membership in the line. If not, we'll come back and try to make a case with you.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? See none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Colleagues, Zach, are we prepared to move this bill?
We are, but there's been talk of removing the subsequent referral to judiciary. So if you want to do that, we'll need to hold till Friday.
Okay, well, sure. Yes.
It's my, and for your benefit and for the benefit of the committee, the co-chair and I have had some discussion about, we're a little confused, or at least I am, about why this came here as opposed to judiciary. I had the pleasure of being on the Judiciary Committee in 2007 and remember some of this discussion. It seemed more appropriate in judiciary, so I'm not entirely sure why we had it. The question for us, given the testimony we had, is whether it needs to go to judiciary again. So we've submitted a letter asking if it might be appropriate to rescind that subsequent referral. It seems to me that we could wait until Friday to get an answer on that. If the answer is no, we can send it to judiciary. If the answer is yes, we can send it right to the floor, assuming the committee is in agreement with that strategy.
That sounds acceptable. No one is objecting. So with that, we'll carry over HB 2468 to Friday. And with that, Zach, have we exhausted everything except our last bill?
I think we
carried that over. Yes, I think, colleagues, because there are so many folks here on HB 3141, I think I'm going to carry over HAM 20, unless there's someone here from far, far away that would like to testify. See no one. If someone comes in from one of the other rooms on HAM 20, we may bring it back. Otherwise, I'm going to carry over HJM 20 to Friday and open a public hearing on HB 3141. The most patient representative in the world is still standing over there. Would you like to come forward? Zach, tell us about this bill.
House Bill 3141 requires only persons under 21 years of age to wear a motorcycle helmet while riding or operating a motorcycle.
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews is here as well.
And we have also two more representatives. Please come up.
I guess, Mr. Chair, we don't need unanimous consent to use visual aids.
I guess we don't.
You're required.
That is a visual aid.
Who wants to go first?
Chair Vance and Chair Reed and committee members, thank you for listening to this today. My name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative out of the Albany area. My testimony is going to be really short, and then I'm going to hand it off to my colleagues here. I also kind of want to give you a little bit of a overview, too, of because we want to do this quickly and share as much information as we possibly can, Chair Bence, and so you can have a good understanding of where we're going with this bill. But House Bill 3141 is a bill that modifies the current motorcycle helmet law. It's a fairly simple bill. At a glance, this is what the bill looks like. First, the rider must be 21 years of age to choose to ride without their helmet. Second, the rider must have a motor vehicle liability insurance policy that provides personal injury protection benefits. The Dash 1 amendments that you have requires coverage at $15,000. The Dash 2 amendments increases the coverage to $25,000. The Dash 3 amendments that are being crafted at this time would reflect equivalent coverage. Now, most of the people that you'll hear testimony from today, as well as just about everybody that's in here right now that rides a motorcycle, are up in the neighborhood of $100,000. I just, you know, you should know that right off the bat. So why? because they're responsible riders. The third portion of the bill creates a window period measuring the outcome of the bill over an 18-month period, and the bill sunsets on January 2, 2013. The Oregon Department of Transportation will submit a report to the 77th Legislative Assembly on or before April 1, 2013, reporting the following information: number of deaths related to motorcycle accidents, cause of the accident and whether the rider was wearing a helmet, whether the person who died was licensed in this state or another state, comparing the results of the window period to the same 18-month period prior to this bill, and determine whether motorcycle ridership increased or decreased, and compare it to the previous 18-month period. Because when you take in consideration what's happening right now for the economic situation with the gas increase and everything, what happened 9 years ago, we saw a large increase in motorcycle operation ridership due to the fuel issue. Now, I've had a number of phone calls, a number of emails. I probably received in the neighborhood of about 4-1 in support of the bill. One question that continually surfaces as a result of this, though in opposition, is if I don't have to wear a helmet, why should I have to wear a seatbelt? It's a good question. But a helmet is not a definitive safety argument in providing safety compared to a seatbelt. The two safety devices cannot be compared. It's like comparing apples to oranges. And having spent 29 years with the Oregon State Police and having responded to a number of incidents involving motorcycles, I would support that comment. With that, I want to hand it over to Representative Freeman.
Thank you, and thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee, for taking time to hear this bill. For the record, I'm Tim Freeman, state representative from House District 2. Today, however, I want to speak to you as an avid motorcycle rider. For my entire life, since I was 3 years old, I've owned a motorcycle, and I've ridden well over 200,000 miles, both in states that required helmets and states that have not. I have ridden quite a bit in Canada and in Mexico. So I have lots of history and experience doing this, and I recognize that does not make me an expert, but I do have some specific expertise in some situations that happened to me personally. You're going to have people testify or explain to you that if, in fact, you got into a motorcycle accident, you may be safer with a helmet on, and that could or could not be argued. The one thing I will promise you is that there's no statistic kept as to the number of accidents that could be avoided if a rider could see or hear. I want you to think about that for a minute. So when you have this helmet on your head, your limited vision is out that little hole, and your ears are covered. So you cannot hear or see what's going on next to you or around you. This very much limits your ability to be aware of your surroundings. Because of that, people get into accidents all the time because they're not able to see or hear something a vehicle driver or even another motorcyclist is doing that is no fault of their own. We don't keep that statistic because it's a non-event. It happens, and you don't. I mean, all we get is the report of how many people were or were not wearing helmets. Nobody ever said, well, you know, let's keep the statistic. If you could have seen or heard and avoided that accident, would you have been safer? And so that's one thing I want you to keep in mind. The other thing is, and when you ride in states that don't require a helmet, they don't keep the statistic as to the number of accidents that were avoided, simply because people could hear and see. And I think those are important things as you hear statistics and justification of why or why we should not have helmet laws in Oregon. One thing that I would very much ask you to do is when people come to testify or talk to you about this particular bill, ask them if they have a motorcycle endorsement. Ask them if they ride motorcycles, because this doesn't affect those out there that don't ride motorcycles. And oftentimes you get the argument that Representative Olson brought up that it's some kind of a parody to vehicles, and it's simply not. There is even an argument out there about the freedom of choice. And I'm not here to make that argument. I'm here to tell you, as somebody that's ridden, again, well over 200,000 miles all across the United States for the majority of my life, I feel that I can see and hear better, that I can avoid accidents if I don't have this thing wrapped around my head. Now, another quick personal experience. About 5 years ago, I was sitting at a red light, minding my own business, following the traffic laws, and a lady did not stop behind me. So she slammed into the back of me on my motorcycle. I will tell you flat out, and my doctor would, if he was here, he would tell you the same thing, my neck was injured to a greater degree because of the weight of the helmet on my head. If you can imagine your body getting jerked forward and this thing jerking your head back, it caused more damage than if I would have not been wearing a helmet. The laws in Oregon require me to wear a helmet and do not allow me to decide what's going to be safe for me, and I think that that is a mistake, and I would love the opportunity to at least have this trial period and pass this law. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Good afternoon, Chair Benz, Co-Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Matthews. I'm a state representative out of House District 50. It's the great city of Gresham. Proud to be here today in support of House Bill 3141. I'm a motorcycle enthusiast as well, former road captain of the Hog Chapter for Rose City. Also a motorcycle cop with about 7 or 8 years experience on motorcycles, currently a fire lieutenant with Gresham. I don't want to talk about my qualifications to be here because everybody has their story, but what I do want to say is that I see this bill more about perception versus reality and philosophical indifference between a lot of folks that say we're protecting you, so therefore wear your helmet so we can protect you, and those that say, look, I would like to be responsible for my own security and my own safety. Please allow me the opportunity to make that choice for myself. And that's where the argument lies. I look at this bill as a very reasonable approach to legislation in accomplishing two things. First of all, it gives us a grace period to look at this issue and to actually have statistical information, something that can be documented support to support the arguments for and against. It's a point-counterpoint built into the bill. That comes back to legislative session to see, are we doing the right thing? The other thing is, too, that we need to remember that this is constituent-driven. Whether you ride a motorcycle or not, the majority of our constituents that are riding want to see us have this choice. Doesn't mean they change their mind. Doesn't mean they won't wear a helmet. For an example, I wore a skid lid, super lightweight helmet for a lot of years. Riding my Harley felt good about that until we had our first baby. My wife, as a gift, gave me a helmet for my daughter. I wear that helmet. That's my choice. Not every day, though. When I went to Colorado Springs, I took my helmet off as we crossed state lines. Didn't think I would, but I enjoyed it. Didn't die as a result of it. Had a great time and had a good ride. Bottom line is, we talk about costs and you talk about health care and you talk about the impact and what these lives lost mean. And yet nobody comes forward to the stats to say this many lives are lost every year. On top of that, I would argue that there's more lives lost to COPD and emphysema and diabetes, and that's what I'm seeing as a firefighter when you talk about health care costs. That's where the increases are. They're not from motorcycles without helmets. So I would just argue that this is a good bill, a great approach. It's reasonable. It's effective. It gives us a chance to kind of come back point counterpoint and have statistics actually drive the argument as opposed to hypothetical what-ifs. Because as a firefighter on the road, I'm not seeing those what-ifs. We don't respond to a lot of motorcycle accidents. And if we respond to a fatal motorcycle accident, the helmet didn't make any difference. Thank you for hearing the bill. I appreciate it, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, if I could, we have a series of three panels, and some of those folks, if you could hold your questions for some of them, it would really be good for you to get firsthand from. I think you understand the mechanics of what the law or what we're trying to do for change here, which I shared. But then to have personal life experience from these other folks that are following might answer a lot of your questions. So if you could indulge me with that. The next panel would be Don Boatwright, who is a retired senior trooper with the Oregon State Police. He's a retired accident reconstructionist. Paul Reyes is currently a medical responder for Portland Fire Bureau. And then the next panel after that is Nick Oliver, who's the executive director of Bike Pack. Al Sims was going to share on public burden from Albany. Sam Hochberg is an attorney from Portland that is going to share his perspective. And then the final panel would be Mel Yeager, Heidi Disrood, and Don Mason. I'll give you this list here.
That'd be fine. Are there questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair,
just a second. Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. My question is we don't have to have the full wraparound helmets, right? I see lots of people wearing some great-looking helmets out there, like old USSR-type helmets that just barely cover their head. What is the true rule on the type of helmets that are required?
Thank you, Co-Chair Benz and Representative Lindsay. I'll get close. The law requires there to be a hard outer shell, a liner, and a chin strap, and it has to bear a DOT sticker. I get close?
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. First, are there helmets designed that increase the ability to hear what's going on around you?
Thank you, Co-Chair Benz and Representative Nathanson. Yes, but because of the strap, almost all helmets cover your ears to some degree, and depending on how the helmet fits or rides on your head, it can, you know, can move around and block the vision. But there's different style helmets, absolutely.
Okay, and the other question is about the way the bill is drafted. It's asking for statistical information on the number of deaths. In deciding what to include in the bill, did you discuss possibly asking for information about serious or permanent injuries, particularly brain injury, for example?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Nathanson, no, we did not. We were specifically identifying what was happening here, and I think the information that you're going to hear from retired Senior Trooper Boatwright will understand and solidify what that's all about for the focus toward the fatality rather than the injury.
Just a brief follow-up.
Listen, just everybody should start keeping everything
okay,
very
sure.
Succinct, or we're not going to get everybody up. So go ahead, okay. Representative Nathanson, please.
Since I don't know who's signed up to testify, I will point out that I did have information from an emergency room physician that indicated to me that I should at least ask about and listen for information about brain injury.
Absolutely.
I'll just wait in here.
Thank you, Representative Widener.
And mine's real quick. I can take the answer offline, but I saw Representative Gilliam walk in here as well. I was just wondering, were the four of you in the movie Wild Hogs?
Oh, God. Nice one. That's wild.
I will note that in the movie Wild Hogs, they didn't, for the most part, did not wear helmets.
Representative Gilliam, would you want
to? You heard from the best. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So you're not wishing to testify?
No.
That's what I'm hearing. Okay, then.
Put that hair.
Okay, then Don Boatwright, Paul Reyes, and Nick Oliver, please. Gentlemen, we're going to start the clock, so 2 minutes, and otherwise there are, I think, another 16 people signed up, so you're going to have to roll around. Who would like to go first? Go ahead.
Yeah, my name is Don Boatwright. I was contacted by Representative Olson to address you with regards to the proposed bill. I am a retired state police officer. I was with the Department of State Police for 23 years. In nine of those years, I was a technical accident investigator. The last 3 years that I was with the department before retirement, I was a motor vehicle collision reconstructionist. I have had training through IPTM, Northwestern University, with regards to motor vehicle collision reconstruction, and IPTM as far as motorcycle reconstruction is concerned. I've, over the years, covered a number of collisions, 154 fatalities with regards to the collisions that I've recovered or covered. Of that, four were motorcycle collisions. Of those four, I reconstructed basically what happened in the collision in three of them. All of the collisions that I responded to throughout my career, I can't think of one instance where the fatality was a result of a non-helmet. I didn't see anyone that didn't have a helmet that was involved in a collision that was a fatality. Basically, what happens as far as motor vehicle collisions are concerned, it's through my training and years of experience that there's actually three collisions that occur in motor vehicles. First is the initial contact as far as the either two vehicles or whatever object they run into. The second is with the occupants of the vehicle contacting the interior part of the motor vehicle. And then the third being the internal organs of the individuals involved impacting the interior or solid parts of their bodies themselves. Depending on the speeds at which they're going, and what I've been trained at is usually the threshold speed for what's going to be a fatality or a survivable accident is 30 miles an hour. Anything over that amount, and we're talking about very rapid, if not instantaneous, deceleration. Okay, and motor cycle.
You're going to have to wrap this up. So please do. So
yeah, motorcycle collisions, there's obviously only two collisions, and that's one with the operator into a vehicle, if that's what they hit, or a fixed object. And the same speeds apply. If the impact's over 30 miles an hour, it doesn't make much difference if the individual's wearing a helmet or not. Internal injuries will determine whether they survive or not.
Thank you. And Mr. in the middle.
Thank you, Co-Chair Benz and Co-Chair Reed and members of the committee. My name is Nick Oliver. I'm the Executive Director of Bike Pack of Oregon. I'm also a 100% disabled vet. Very happily married, father of seven, and grandfather of 15, with one more on the way. Bike Pack of Oregon represents the combined motorcyclists here in Oregon of over 130,000. And I want to say one thing right off the bat. Helmets have never once prevented an accident. Not once. We have issues that are coming up that I have expert researchers doing to come over this. But I would like to say that there are certain conditions where a helmet can prevent head injury. There's no doubt about it. We're not here to deny it. All we're here for is to ask for our freedom to choose what is the best in safety equipment for us. After riding for over 40 years, believe me, I know what I like to on and what I don't. And over 40 pounds of leather makes a heck of a difference, especially when you're a fat man like me. The right to choose to wear a helmet should be left up to the individual because obviously they know what's best for them. Some things will work for them, some won't. This full-face helmet, I've tried them. It's like trying to wear a bowling ball on my head. I don't like it, and I got the half shell myself, and I like that one. But under this bill, under no circumstances, does it change anybody's ability to wear a helmet. It's not going to be infringed upon. Voluntary use is always going to be up to the individual. And most people will choose to wear it because that's what they like. But we have an opportunity here to correct the mistakes of the past. And that's what I'm asking for your help with. One of the problems is the sunset clause. 18 months is not enough time to do an appropriate study. Even the federal government's most current record from NHTSA was 2008. That's 2.5 years ago. I would ask that you consider a sunset clause of 5 years. That'll give enough time to put the study together to get things going.
Thank you, Mr. Oliver. That your 2 minutes is up. So we'll go to the next witness, who is Representative Reyes. I'm sorry, Representative.
That works.
I'm not sure I promoted you.
Thank you, Co-Chairs and Representatives. My name is Paul Reyes. I'm a firefighter EMT for the city of Portland. I have been for the last 23 years. I've been an avid motorcyclist since the 70s and clock around 12,000 miles annually on my motorcycle. As an emergency responder, I've been to many motorcycle accident scenes around the Portland area. Some of these accidents were on residential streets and some were on freeways. Of all the motorcycle accidents that I've been involved with, I have not been to one yet that I would say, wow, this individual's helmet made the difference in the injuries that they sustained. As a trained EMT, one of the first things I assess is if there's any significant damage to their helmet. This information is passed on in a written report and verbally to the transportating personnel. If an accident is so severe, be it speed-related or impact with a stationary object, the trauma sustained by the individual is such that the protection that their helmet may have provided is not the issue.
There are many studies that could be brought up, but I'm sure that you have already seen them, so I will not bring them up here. If safety is a paramount issue, then the best way to achieve this is to become more proficient as a motorcyclist through training. That will reduce the incidence of motorcycle accidents and injuries with a far greater return than helmet wear. Not to mention that being a responsible adult motorcyclist with the proper insurance protection, you should have the freedoms of choice, as this is what our society system and our system of government is founded on. I would like to thank you for the opportunity that you afforded me to testify here today and hope that you would find in favor of House Bill 3141. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reyes. Are there questions for this panel?
Yes.
Representative Widener.
Real quick, have you followed Arizona, any one of the three of you?
I've lived there.
Because I know there's not a helmet law there. Has there been any studies or anything done there where there's...
There has never been a conclusive study done anywhere. That's the problem with the appropriate items being delineated to maintain the granularity of the study, unfortunately.
Coach Benz, Representative Ryder. I also shared with Representative Olson some studies that have been done. They were published in a magazine called Motorcycle Consumer News that stated in states that don't have helmet laws and states that do have helmet laws that the only thing that really has been an indicator as to the safety of the individual is the amount of advanced training that they've received, not the helmet wear.
Yeah, education.
I know there's a question from Representative Smith, but while he's asking it, we would like to have Steve Walker, Jim Anderson, and Dr. Mayberry come up, so they're ready to go as soon as Representative Smith has asked his question.
I can wait till the next panel.
Great. Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
And again, Steve Walker, Jim Anderson, John Mayberry.
Mr. Chair, Jim Anderson, here today as the government outreach specialist for the Oregon chapter, American College of Emergency Physicians, and we are in opposition to House Bill 3141. Everyone is one step away from an emergency, a medical emergency, and it's our experience that helmets work. Reputable scientific and medical research indicates that head injuries are a leading cause of death in motorcycle crashes. When involved in a crash, an unhelmeted motorcyclist is 40% more likely to incur a fatal head injury and 15% more likely to incur a non-fatal head injury than a helmeted motorcycle rider. The Crash Outcome Data Evaluation System, otherwise known as CODES study, found that motorcycle helmets are 67% effective in preventing brain injuries, and unhelmeted motorcyclists involved in crashes were more than three times more likely to suffer pain, a brain injury, than those using helmets. Nationwide, taxpayers pay 60 to 80% of the cost of caring for injured motorcycle riders, and brain injuries require costly treatment and rehabilitation. According to the Hospital and Health System Association, the average cost of hospitalization for a motorcyclist with head injury is more than $43,000. Federal law, EMTALA, which we operate under, requires hospitals and the accompanying emergency departments to stabilize these patients, even though less than half the cost of motorcycle injuries is covered by private health insurance. The remaining cost for caring of insured motorcyclists is then shifted to state taxpayers and health care providers. I would just leave you with the, since I see I'm being red-lighted, I would leave you with the thought that we are opposed to House Bill 3141. I have passed out information that I would encourage you to read. There's one from Johns Hopkins University that studies, and it's a recent study in February that addresses the issue that was brought up earlier by a representative, and it deals with spinal cord injury, and there is a definite correlation.
Thank you. And I'm not sure whether Mr. Walker or Dr. Mayberry is next, but whichever of you is in the middle, please go.
Okay. I'm Steve Walker. I'm an avid motorcyclist, owner of OregonMotorcyclist.com, and a concerned citizen. I hope this is brief testimonies. I hope this bill's life is brief. 2008 report by the Oregon Transportation Safety Division stated that from 2002 to 2006, motorcycle crashes nearly doubled. Their conclusion was, clearly we must do something different than in the past to reverse this deadly trend. In the 2009 Oregon legislative session, Senator Vicky Walker, at my urging, did something different. Senator Walker introduced and got passed SB 546, which phases in over a five-year period mandatory rider training for all new motorcycle endorsees in the state of Oregon. In addition, there were two other bills that were passed as incentives for training. SB 124 doubled the fines for riding unendorsed and requires a course to suspend the fine if the rider completes a rider training course. House Bill 2370 required insurance companies to provide a discount on motorcycle insurance to riders to complete training. These groundbreaking laws were designed with one purpose, to save lives. Study after study confirms anyone who has studied motorcycle safety realizes that training is the number one deterrent to motorcycle crashes. Nearly half of motorcycle fatalities in Oregon are people simply riding off the road because they don't know how to handle their bike. Not one rider advocacy group formally opposed any of that legislation because every rider knows training does save lives. So what does this have to do with repealing Oregon's motorcycle helmet law? If your helmet law is weakened, the lives saved by the 2009 legislation will be more than offset by the lives surely lost by the repeal of the universal helmet law. Every state that has repealed their universal helmet law has seen a dramatic increase in deaths and serious injury resulting from head trauma. The increase in motorcycle fatalities in these states ranged anywhere from 25% to 100%. In 2008, there were 47 motorcycle fatalities in Oregon. If these trends experienced by other states hold true in Oregon, and there's no reason to believe they won't, that means that 12 to 47 more Oregon citizens will die needlessly, not to mention the many with only permanent impairment.
Mr. Walker, we're going to have to ask you to wrap it up.
I will wrap it up.
Thank you.
You represent all of your constituents. That includes spouses, children, extended family members, co-workers, neighbors. Ask them what they all think of our current helmet law. Please don't let a vocal minority weaken a law that an overwhelming majority of Oregonians believe in and counts on to protect the lives of their loved ones and acquaintances.
Thank you. Dr. Mayberry.
Chair Benz, Chair Reed, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. Also, my name is John Mayberry. I'm a trauma surgeon, professor of surgery practicing at OHSU. I'm the physician that meets the patients in the emergency room and takes them to the operating room or to the ICU and then takes care of them while they're in the hospital and then sees them in clinic when they come back from the nursing home. I'm here representing the Oregon Medical Association, and we are opposed to House Bill 3141 for three reasons. Number one, because motorcycle helmets prevent brain injury, save lives, and because they result in extensive cost systems to our system. As mentioned, helmets themselves do not prevent motorcycle crashes, but they have been proven to prevent deaths and unnecessary injuries. In states like Oregon, where helmet legislation has been enacted, helmets have been proven to reduce deaths by an average of 35% and brain injuries by 67%. In regards to the cost of the system, it's estimated that billions of dollars in health care costs have been saved due to riders wearing helmets. NHTSA data concludes that 50% of motorcycle riders across the country do not have private health insurance, which means here in Oregon it would be Oregon taxpayers who would ultimately pay the short and long-term costs of care for any motorcycle rider involved in an accident without a helmet. The cost for one patient with a devastating head injury, as far as acute hospitalization, exceeds $100,000. And several hundreds of thousands of dollars in long-term care charges over the life of these severely debilitated patients. I'd be happy to take any of the representatives onto our trauma ward at your request at Oregon Health Sciences University and see some of these patients for yourself. At a time when the state has very limited dollars and numerous committees are examining ways to reduce health care costs, if this is not the time to consider repealing Oregon's motorcycle helmet law. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Widener.
Just real quick, and this will be for one of the doctors, but this bill here is actually making them carry personal liability or personal injury protection on their insurance. To me, I think we have a bigger problem when the kid, which I was one of these crazy kids who would get on my dirt bike and jump over the dirt pile, try and go further and further, and to me, that's where the crazy accidents that you see are probably from dirt bike riders more than guys on street bikes, aren't they?
I don't have specific data regarding you're talking about dirt bikes as opposed to people riding motorcycles down the highway,
yeah,
or on residential streets. No, no, that's not been my experience.
Sorry, Representative, but we very much want to get a few more people in. Further questions? See none. Thank you very much for coming down and sharing with us. Al Sims, Sam Hochberg, Mel Yeager. And folks, this hearing room is taken up by another group, oddly enough, the Healthcare Committee, and they will be coming through that door in a few moments, and they'll wreck havoc on those of us not wearing helmets. And so I encourage you to keep your testimony short. We're going to shorten the speaking time to a minute and a half, Zach. Please proceed, whichever one is ready. We have 8 minutes left, folks, so this is the best we can do. Go ahead.
Okay, my name is Al Sims. I'm from Albany, Oregon. I appreciate you people letting us come here and have this little hearing. This is an important subject we need to talk about. If the PowerPoint presentation is up, I have some charts here. Everybody's sick of charts and numbers. These are from NHTSA 2008, their latest data. And it's the most verifiable thing that I could find anywhere with a couple of research people looking. These first two charts would be from NHTSA, so we have some pretty good representation of statistics. So from there, I'd like to tell you that I've owned a motorcycle since 1969 when I traded my first summer of hauling hay for a yellow Honda 90. This is something I've done a long time and I'm real proud of. I think something I'd like to present to you in your economic committee hearing here is that public burden spending, for the sake of this discussion, is defined as any spending by government for which the beneficiary is not required to make restitution, because that's what people use against helmets, is public burden theory.
Well, you're cutting into my minute and a half, Mel.
Jeez.
Whatever made me do it.
Okay, let's see. With that, I'd just like to say examples of public burden spending include various forms of social support services, emergency rescue operations, grants of state money, and yes, unpaid health care costs incurred by health care facilities. Tobacco users, cancer victims, illegal aliens, accident victims of all type are treated in full care in our facilities without the prerequisite to pay. And public burden spending is a fact of our humanitarian society. That's what America does. We take care of all humans regardless of the reason for debilitation. Even citizens of a foreign nation who will never reciprocate anything to Oregon's economy are in fact a public burden. This is demonstrated by our philanthropic outpouring of funds to help with the Japanese and Haitian disasters. With that, we should spend this money wisely that we think we're spending on public burden. We need to look at a revenue stream to help Oregon. We're running out of money. We're in trouble with the governor. All these things. I would like you to look at these charts that you'll be able to see after my time is done.
And but, your time sadly,
it
is done.
Is.
Yes, and then we're going to move to the gentleman in the middle. Just again, I want to get as much information from as many people as we can, so go ahead.
Sure, thank you. My name is Sam Hochberg. I'm an attorney in Oregon, practicing for 27 years. 25 of those, a lot of his motorcycle cases. I've handled more probably than anybody in the state on the plaintiff side. But if we really wanted to prevent head injuries, we'd stop picking on motorcyclists and make Oregon's bicyclists, skiers, skateboarders, snowboarders, bungee jumpers, skydivers, and even car drivers wear helmets. There are a lot more head injuries in car wrecks and all these other kinds of wrecks than motorcycle wrecks. Now imagine, if you will, wearing this full-face helmet while you're driving a car. It seems absurd. And now you know how motorcyclists feel. it seems absurd to us to not have the choice on the circumstance and when it's going to be useful and when it isn't. Two quick legal issues. First, if the committee is to amend the bill to add PIP, I agree with the -3 equivalency amendment that would say you have to carry either PIP or $15,000 in medical payments or equivalent to health coverage. Same as the Texas law, by the way. The third element of this that's very important is to make this, and I don't believe this is in one of the amendments, a secondary offense. So to avoid enforcement problems, the infraction of failing to wear a helmet would be secondary, meaning the police could not stop a rider solely because he isn't wearing a helmet. If he's not wearing a helmet and stopped for something else, you just have to show you've got a card showing you've got health insurance of some sort and that you took motorcycle rider training. And that's exactly what the Texas law is. I'm going to have a... Sorry I didn't have a copy of that before. But
thank you. With that, I'm going to have to go to our last witness for today because we now are down to roughly 2 minutes before our next person comes. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. My name is Mel Yeager. I'm the Secretary Treasurer of Bike Pack of Oregon, also a citizen of Albany. Lived there for 61 years, and during that time I spent 9 years in the military serving Uncle Sam. And one of the things that we were required to do when we enlisted was to swear allegiance to the U.S. Constitution. I'm sure that as public officials, you are sworn in to your office, and you are required to uphold the Constitution as well. Well, that was just a part of life. And one of the things that the Constitution provides in the preamble is the ability of every citizen of the USA to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Be able to make decisions for themselves what they need to do to live a good and happy life. And I don't like the fact that the rights to choose have been taken away from the citizen of the USA. I fought for 9 years in different theaters of operation to protect those rights for everybody in this country. And I got back to the USA and found out that my citizens won't let me make a decision that is life-saving or possibly life-threatening in my own behalf and for my own interests. So I ask you, from an emotional point of view, to look at this and give us back the right to make a choice for ourselves. That's all we're asking with this bill, the right to choose, to make a choice to live our life the way we would like to do it. We are all responsible citizens. We have our insurances. We've been riding motorcycles, in my case, for 60 years. And I appreciate being able to be here to testify in front of you today, and I ask you to please vote to approve and pass Bill 3141, and I thank you very much.
We thank you very much. Thanks for your service, and thank you, panel. And folks, we have 2 minutes left, but I'm going to, at this point, close this public hearing on 3141. We appreciate your insight, and we'll discuss among ourselves what to do next with this bill. Thank you very much. And with that, we're adjourned.